morning. I'm very pleased to be here, and especially since I was born in 1937. And if it were not for modern medicine, I wouldn't be here. The average age of life expectancy in the ancient world, even for Israelite kings, was in the 40s, and even for Egyptian pharaohs in the 40s. And not until the Industrial Revolution did that extend much beyond that. And even if I were alive and in those circumstances, I probably couldn't see you because, without glasses and without cataracts, I can't read and I see you dimly, and then without hearing aids, both ears, which I constantly lose, I couldn't hear you if you were to ask a question. And without dental implants, I'd have a hard time eating and articulating. And, come to think of it, my lovely wife, without her implants, she'd look like a toothless crone. So we have to be very, very grateful for modern medicine. There are some handouts there. I hope you will get them or will pick them up on your way. They indicate the very few places where physicians are mentioned in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. Physicians were called Rofe, means the healer. And by and large, all of the references in both the Old and the New Testament are either neutral or in some cases negative. And this is part of a larger reference work that I've been working on, in the background of the Bible. And I continue this study with respect to the ancient Near East, Mesopotamia, ancient Egypt, from which we have a lot of information, ancient Greece, ancient Rome, and something which I'll not be able to discuss because of the time limitation is the role of physicians in early Judaism, in the Talmud, for example, and in early Christianity in the early patristic era. So let me begin speaking about the physicians in the area of Mesopotamia, which is today, of course, Iraq. Demonic activity was presumed to be the source of almost all illnesses, sometimes also a curse by someone who was your enemy. For example, a passage reads, the Ashaku demon attacks the head of the man. The Namtaru demon attacks the life of the man. The bad Utuku demon attacks the neck of the man. The bad Alu demon attacks the breast of the man, and so forth and so on. So by and large, the etiology of disease in Mesopotamia, and we have a lot of cuneiform texts that go into this, was ascribed to demon activity. And the Code of Hammurabi, for example, has some very interesting legislation about surgeons. According to Codex Hammurabi 206, quote, if a man has hit a man in a fight and inflicted him with a wound, that man shall take an oath, I did not strike knowingly, and shall be answerable for payment to the physician. According to Codex Hammurabi 215, if a physician made a serious wound on a man with a bronze scalpel and healed the man, or opened a man's temple with a bronze scalpel and healed the man's eye, he shall charge 10 shekels of silver as his fee. A shekel of silver is about a quarter of an ounce of silver, equivalent to a month's wage. So that's 10 months' wages. According to Codex Hammurabi 221, if a physician mended a man's broken bone or healed a sore tendon, the patient shall pay the physician 5 shekels of silver. And then it varies according to whether you're a free citizen, a commoner, or a slave. And then, of course, there is the punitive malpractice clause. If you cut a man and lost his arm, your arm would be cut off. So this is a very dangerous and perilous profession to pursue in antiquity. Now, we have an important text called the so-called Diagnostic Handbook, which dates from about the 11th century, and it lists symptoms of a variety of diseases from the head to the feet. Its 40 tablets are arranged in 6 chapters of unequal length with about 3,000 entries. Each case includes the name of the disease, its divine sender, the development of the disease, and the chance of the sick man's recovery, which are usually not very good. All kinds of omens are included, and so forth. And the main way to discern the will of our gods in Mesopotamia was hepatoscopy. That is, examination of the liver of sheep, and these are correlated with various events and signs from the gods. Now, from the 10th century BC on, there was an increasing emphasis on attending to astrological omens. This is in connection with the analysis of diseases and so forth. Now, there's also the tendency to ascribe the disease to one's relationship to a personal god. If a personal god abandoned the man, and so that person would get sick. Various gods were invoked for healing, especially the god Gula, G-U-L-A, whose temple was at Nippur, and whose favorite animal was a dog. Gula was the patron of physicians, and she boasted, "I am a physician. I am able to heal. I carry around all kinds of plants. I drive away illness. I gird myself with a leather bag with curative incantations." Most medicines were made up from plants, and some may have been effective. Now, Gula could also be invoked to bring illness upon an enemy, and so she played a dual role. Now, there are two main medical practitioners in Mesopotamia. First, there was someone called an Ashipu, who is usually translated as an exorcist, or sometimes the magician. This Ashipu was a priest who was an expert in diagnosing who sent the illness, what supernatural demon sent the illness. The Ashipu examined the patients in their homes, laid hands on them, listened to their breathing. He offered his services for free. A common practice was to place a suckling pig or kid upon the patient in order to transfer the illness to the animal, which was then destroyed. The second medical practitioner was the Asu, A-S-U, who appeared as early as 2500 B.C. The Akkadian word is usually translated physician, but it resembled more of a pharmacist, as most of his remedies were made of drugs. By the way, the word pharmacist comes from the Greek word pharmakos, which can mean either a drug for good or evil. In the New Testament, it always has a negative connotation. Now, the profession of the Ashipu was quite rare in the Old Babylonian period, but increased in the Middle Babylonian and the Middle Assyrian era, that is about 1200 B.C. Now, we have the names of certain physicians, but I'll skip that. I do have some copies of the printed text for those of you who may be interested that contains more of this information. The most common remedy for illnesses thought curable were prescriptions called bultu, which means that which restores life, made of all kinds of plants. And another term for the prescription was called shamu, which actually means plants. Now, the most common liquid solvent was beer, but also used were milk, oil, and wine. The oldest prescription is a large tablet in Sumerian that dates from the 21st century B.C. It was published by Samuel Noah Kramer. I had the privilege of studying one summer under Sam Kramer when he came to Brandeis University. Let me turn to the subject of medicine and physicians in Egypt, from which we have a great deal of information. The Egyptians were famous in antiquity for their physicians. The Babylonians wanted Egyptian physicians sent to the royal court. The Greeks also highly prized Egyptian medical tradition. The Egyptians appealed to a variety of gods for healing, such as Hathor, Khnum, Heket, and so forth. The priests of Sekhmet, the god who both sent and cured disease, were called Wab. And there's an interesting protective demons also. A very popular demon was a bandy dwarf, dwarfish god that looks rather grotesque, called Bes, B-E-S. And she protected women in childbirth against demons that would interrupt her pregnancy. There are many temples later on in Egyptian history from about 1200 B.C. of Bes and similar gods where patients would come and would practice incubation, that is, the deliberate seeking of dreams from the gods for directions about healing. We have a wealth of sources for medicine in Egypt, including some medical papyri. Egypt is the only place where the climate is dry enough for papyri to be preserved. And I will not go into all of these different medical papyri, but some of them are very, very old, from the Pyramid Age. One papyrus, especially called the Edwin Smith's papyrus, is relatively objective in terms of the diagnosis of fractures, for example, and the prognosis for healing and cures for attempting the healing. Another very large papyrus called the Ebers papyrus that has a lot of prescriptions, some of which are magical, and so forth and so on. So we have about a half a dozen of these medical papyri, which are exceedingly valuable and informative. The Ebers papyrus, which I mentioned, is 20 meters long, which is like 20 yards long. And it includes a lot of medical ingredients like frankincense, for example, which is a rosin, which is mentioned, of course, in the New Testament. The Old Testament, myrrh and frankincense are very similar. And they were used in medicine. Also, sodium carbonate was used. Now, in the medical text, 160 plants are listed, but only 20% of these have been identified. Dill, which is mentioned as a main ingredient of many recipes, was found around the mummy of Merneptah, a very famous pharaoh. The lotus, which was native to Egypt, was used to control hair loss. It was taken for liver ailments. Cumin, which was native to Central Asia, was used for belly aches. In the tomb of Tutankhamun were found 8 baskets filled with fruits of the coriander, which was probably intended for medicinal purposes in the afterlife. Now, the Egyptians, of course, as you all know, mummified their dead. And this was made possible in the first place by the very dry climate of Egypt. But then you had to get rid of certain organs and prevent the decay caused by fluids. So as Herodotus, the Greek historian, describes it in the most detail, he visited Egypt in the 5th century B.C., the Egyptians would use natron, which was a naturally found desiccating agent, to dry out the fluids. They would remove 4 major organs and place them in canopic jars. They would leave the heart in the body. Now, the brain, this is very interesting, they thought was just stuffing for the head, and they would take the brain out through the nose with a long hook. And I always tell my students when I lectured on Egyptian history, you know, I hope that your brain is more than stuffing for your head. And I had lectured before in my Egyptian history classes that the close experience that the Egyptians had with cadavers probably gave them some superior medical knowledge. And as I did further research, I found this is not the case. Though the biblical text talks about physicians mummifying, the physicians in ancient Egypt did not mummify. There was a separate guild. Those who worked on mummification were not physicians, and they didn't transmit any knowledge to the physicians. The Egyptians believed that most diseases was caused by a noxious substance called wekhdu, which is formed from the residue of undigested food. They believed this flowed backwards from the large intestine to the heart and was then distributed throughout the body by vessels called metu. The wekhdu was also believed to turn into worms. All these ailments were counted by emetics, which caused vomiting and enemas. We know the names of about 150 physicians. The word for physician is sonu, 62 from the Old Kingdom, that is from the earliest period of the Pyramid Ages and so forth. Now, we also have some very interesting information about dental specialists. And I have a separate article on dentistry and teeth in this project that I'm working on. But some of the earliest dentists are mentioned in the Old Kingdom period, the very earliest period, about 2500 B.C. But an examination of thousands of mummies, including the very famous royal mummies, shows that the Egyptian dentists were not able to do very much. Most of the problems of teeth in Egypt were caused not by caries, because there was no sugar in the diet, but by sand grit that got into the flour and that wore off the enamel. And many of the pharaohs had lost their teeth or had abscesses and so forth. And even the most famous pharaoh, Ramses II, whom some scholars believe is the pharaoh of the Exodus, even though he was a prodigious builder and was very successful in military, and so he must have suffered terribly from tooth decay. His son Merneptah, in whose stela is the only mention of Israel, about 1220 BC, had lost all of his teeth by the time he died. So we have empirical evidence there that although you have the titles of physicians and dentists, they really weren't able to do much. Now, there were some teeth that were put together with gold filling, and maybe that kept some teeth in the mouth longer. Let me go on to speak about physicians and medicine in Greece. And I'm just picking and being very selective here because of our limited time. We have the first reference to a physician in the Linear B tablets, which are found in Crete and in Greece. The word in Linear B is called iate, which represents the Greek word iater. And we get the word iatros, or physician, as in pediatrics, meaning the doctor who attends to the paidos, or the children. Physicians are mentioned very frequently in the Homeric epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey. And in the two Homeric poems, 149 wounds are described, 75% of which proved to be fatal, which is probably accurate. The most famous healing god was Asclepius. His symbol is a staff with intertwined snakes, and that still appears in physicians' offices and so forth. Now, Asclepius became the patron god of healing centers, especially on an island called Kos, C-O-S, southwest of Turkey, and as the main site called Epidaurus, which is near Mycenae in the Peloponnesus, northeastern part of the Peloponnesus, south of Athens, and also Pergamum, one of the cities of seven cities of the Book of Revelation, western Turkey. And this is where patients would come to practice incubation, as I mentioned before. They would await a dream, which a priest would then interpret. And we have stela, that is, stone inscriptions, of testimonies of people who swear that they have been healed by the visitation of the gods, sometimes by the gods' sacred animal, which is either a serpent or a dog. And there are dozens and dozens of these testimonies of healing at these places. There's also the practice of dedicating simulacra, that is, models of the limbs which have been healed, for example, an arm. And what's very interesting is that this practice persisted over the millennia, so that even in the Greek Orthodox Church, on icons, you'll see silver replicas of the limb or arm that was healed. Now, the first, the greatest of the physicians, of course, was Hippocrates. And there are many treatises that are ascribed to him and to his disciples. And these are fascinating and very informative. There are about 60 essays in this corpus, only a few of which can be ascribed directly to Hippocrates. For example, the aphorisms and prognostics on regimen in acute diseases and so forth. Now, the treatise called Physician advises that the ideal doctor must be clean in person, well-dressed, and anointed with sweet-smelling unguents. A physician is one who, quote, sees terrible sights, touches unpleasant things, and the misfortune of others, and brings a harvest of sorrows that are peculiarly his. And you're, of course, all familiar with the Hippocratic Oath, which is probably influenced by the Pythagorean sect that believed in reincarnation. The best-known Hippocratic work is called On the Sacred Disease, which debunked the idea that epilepsy was caused by a supernatural demon. Rather, the Hippocratic School of Medicine identified four essential humors. And I think most of you are familiar with these humors that include blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. And it was the balance of these humors that either caused health if they were in balance, or caused disease if they were not in good balance. Now, the belief that inflammation was caused by an excess of blood led to the practice of bloodletting, sometimes called phlebotomy, or venesection. Usually the blood is taken out of the veins of the arm. The Romans developed suction cups that they heated to facilitate the bleeding. That practice was to continue into relatively recent times. For example, George Washington in 1799 was bled by his physicians three or four times and probably led to his death. Now, a very important physician is Herophilus in Alexandria in the 3rd century B.C. And Herophilus and Aristocritus, who's also practicing at the same time, were the ones who performed dissection of human bodies. There's only a narrow window of time in ancient history before Vesalius in the Renaissance where the dissection of bodies and cadavers was permitted. And they even performed, it's alleged, vivisection of criminals. But even this experiment did not yield necessarily accurate information. The ancients, with very few exceptions, believed that arteries did not carry blood, that they carried air or something else. And it was not until 1634 that William Harvey in England discerned the true nature of the circulation of blood. Now the Romans, skipping to the field of the Romans, did not have any medical tradition that was sophisticated. Cato, a very famous conservative, talked about using cabbage for all kinds of cures and so forth. But the Romans, as in so many other spheres of culture, were indebted to the Greeks. They depended on the Greeks for philosophy, for literature, for art, and above all, in this case, for medicine. They consulted the Sibylline books and invited the god Asclepius to come from Asia Minor to Rome in the form of a snake. And the myth of the legend is that when it got to the island of Rome, the snake went overboard onto the island, and there an Asclepian was dedicated. The Roman form of the name is Aesculapius. And fittingly, there's a hospital there to this day. Now, most of the physicians in the Roman period, this is from 2nd century B.C. on, were Greeks. And Cato, the censor, for example, distrusted Greek physicians. He thought that they would poison the Romans. When we get to Julius Caesar, Julius Caesar granted Greek physicians Roman citizenship in 46 B.C. The Emperor Augustus exempted physicians from public taxes. He was grateful for his personal physician, Antonius Musa, former slave of Mark Antony, who had cured him from a certain illness by cold water treatment in 23 B.C. Subsequent emperors paid generous salaries to their court physicians. And I won't have time to go over all of this, but these are in the paper. I'll come to the most famous Roman physician of all, who was a court physician to the emperor Marcus Aurelius and his son Commodus. And that's the famous medical authority, Galen, G-A-L-E-N. Galen came from the city of Pergamum in western Anatolia or Turkey. He was a firm believer in dreams. His father had a dream that caused him to be apprenticed as a doctor to the medical school at Pergamum at the age of 16. And Galen studied medicine not only in Pergamum, at Corinth, but also at Alexandria. He studied for 12 years, and that was much longer than most doctors study. Most doctors study only for 3 years as apprentice. There was no formal medical school, but rather a system of apprenticeship. Now, Galen performed dissections on Barbary apes and even experimented on himself. He demonstrated that the brain controlled the voice by severing the laryngeal nerves on live animals. He confirmed that arteries carried blood, a notion that was denied by almost all predecessors. He was a devoted physician, working tirelessly for not only wealthy clients, but also for the health of slaves, making house calls, and getting little sleep at night. He was able to remove cataracts and had a high rate of success in treating his patients. He was also very wealthy, and because of his wealth, he was able to dictate many treatises, of which 83 are extant. He corresponded with physicians through the breadth and length of the Roman Empire, from Spain in the west to Asia Minor in the east. He was a devoted follower to the Hippocratic school and his teaching of the four humors. He believed that all diseases were caused by dyskrasia, that is, an imbalance of the humors. Now, Galen's influence dominated the Middle Ages. His was among the major textbooks, along with Avicenna, Ibn Sina of Iran. When I was at a table with George Murphy, pointed out the fact that in my abstract, I had not mentioned the famous passage in Ben Sira or Ecclesiasticus, which is very positive toward physicians. And let me, since it's let me quote this passage as a kind of fitting conclusion. Ecclesiasticus, who wrote about 190 B.C., lavishes praise on the physician as God's provision for man's illnesses. Quote, honor the physician with the honor due him according to your need of him. For the Lord created him for healing, comes from the Most High, and he will receive a gift from the King. The skill of the physician lifts up his head, and in his presence of in the presence of great men, he is admired. And that's a remarkable passage in Ben Sira. Now, just to conclude, we probably don't realize how recently our medical advances have been, only in the last, say, two centuries. I mentioned Harvey's discovery of the circulation of blood in 1634. Thereafter, there were experiments of blood transfusion by both in France under Louis XIV and in England. Christopher Wren, who's famous for building St. Paul's Cathedral, participated in these experiments of transfusion, sometimes of animal blood to humans. But it was not until 1901 when the discovery of the four blood types was made that really safe blood transfusions could be made. Because there was no anesthesia or antiseptic in ancient times and until relatively modern times, surgery was always painful and almost often very fatal. Some of you are aware that it was a Scottish obstetrician who, in 1847, James Simpson, offered chloroform to a woman in labor. Now, not as well known is the fact that there was a Japanese doctor, Hanaoku Seishu, who had experimented on his mother and his wife slightly before that time. This is recounted in a fascinating historical novel called The Doctor's Wife, based on this fact. And it was not until the 19th century that James Simpson, another Scot, this time a surgeon, used carbolic acid or fennel to this was late in the 19th century, to disinfect his surgical instruments. So again, all hail to those of you who are physicians, and thank you for your service to mankind. Thank you.